From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his annual State of the Nation address today ahead of an election later this month that he's expected to win. In a speech that lasted nearly 2 hours, Putin celebrated Russian military advances and promised to cut poverty in half over the course of his next six-year term. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Lucian Kim in Moscow. And Lucian, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
Well, so let's start with the simple fact that Vladimir Putin spent a lot of time during this address showing off new weapon systems, and he played several videos demonstrating new technology, including unmanned submarines and a cruise missile that could, quote, reach anywhere in the world.
Despite of all the difficulties that we faced over the years, economic and financial problems, problems with our defense industry, with our armed forces, Russia remained a major nuclear power, but nobody wanted to talk to us seriously. They kept ignoring us. Nobody listened to us. So listen to us now.
Of course, that's Vladimir Putin speaking through a translator. Lucian, what do you make of his tone? How unusual is it for a speech like this?
Well, I'm not sure if it's usual for any State of the Nation speech, but it's not that unusual for Putin, especially in the past years. I think what's striking about this speech is the level of detail that he went into describing these super weapons. I don't think any of this is news to people in the Pentagon who are tracking new Russian weapons programs. And, of course, most of the footage that was shown was computer animation. But I think to many Russians, it was news that, you know, Russia has such a high-tech weapons program and is, you know, ready to resist any attack by the United States.
Interesting. But despite all his bellicose talk, though, Putin, in addition, claimed that Russia isn't gearing up for a military confrontation. So let's listen to that.
We have never had any plans to attack anybody. We are not going to take anything away from anybody. We have everything we need. On the contrary, I'd like to emphasize, and this is very important, Russia's growing military power is just a guarantee of peace on our planet, because this military might will preserve the strategic balance, the balance of forces in the world.
The balance of forces in the world and preservation of peace through powers. To my ear, this harkens back to the Cold War. But, I mean, what is Putin trying to say here?
Well, in some ways, this is the standard Russian position, namely that Russia is for a so-called multipolar world and working with other world powers, including the U.S., but also China, India, and others, and is against a world dominated by the U.S. And, you know, in some ways, you mentioned it, that it, you know, sounds a little bit like the Cold War. Well, in some ways, the Russian position doesn't really sound very different from Soviet foreign policy, right? Because the Soviet Union, as it saw itself, was also as a force for peace against American imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Well, shortly after his assurance that Russia doesn't want to attack anyone, Putin saying that, he did go on to mention the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review that was released last month. And that's the review in which the United States proposed developing new, smaller atomic bombs in part to counter Russia. And then Vladimir Putin had this to say.
Any use of nuclear weapons against Russia or its allies, small range, medium range, any kind of attack will be regarded as a nuclear attack against Russia. And in response, we will take action instantaneously, no matter what the consequences are.
And your thoughts on that, Lucian?
I actually agree. I think it's a response to the Trump administration's nuclear posture review, in which the U.S. says it may consider the use of these so-called tactical or limited nuclear strikes in response to non-nuclear attacks, including cyber attacks. Russia itself, you know, isn't really in a position to escalate the situation. I think the idea here is really to keep the U.S. on guard.
You do make a good point, though, that an increase in sort of militaristic language isn't limited to Moscow. But beyond that, Lucian, Putin talked about things that are outside of the realm of weapons and the military. He said he wants to cut poverty in Russia in half. How is his speech being received in Russia?
I think that he did devote the first part of his speech to domestic politics, which wasn't necessarily because of economic problems, wasn't necessarily a very rosy story. But really, the foreign policy part dominated, and I think it's also dominating the news cycle now. And that's really just good news, right? From a Russian perspective, we're competing with the Americans, and the Americans are never going to try to bully us again. This is really a fear that goes back to the Cold War and resonates with a lot of people. I've been speaking to many Russians in the past couple of weeks, and many say they are unhappy with the domestic situation, but they're still going to support Putin because of his foreign policy, because he's raised Russia's position on the world stage.
Well, that's Lucian Kim, Moscow correspondent for NPR. Lucian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., it's been a difficult week for President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner. He's been working for 10 months with temporary top security clearance that was downgraded on Tuesday. On Wednesday, reports that four foreign governments thought they could manipulate him because of his financial investments. Today, new questions about hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to his family's Kushner companies by business leaders with whom he met in the White House. Kate Kelly was part of a reporting team for the New York Times. Kate, how much were the loans and what were they for?
So the loans were $184 million to Kushner companies from a private equity firm known as Apollo Global Management, and also $325 million from Citigroup, the large universal bank where many of your listeners probably have an account.
And we're understanding that even by the standards of these huge companies, especially Apollo, these were big loans. What were they for?
The Apollo loan was strikingly large by that company's standards. It was three times the size of the average loan in their commercial real estate portfolio. And that was in connection with refinancing a Chicago office tower that is the Midwest headquarters of AT&T.
And that's owned by the Kushner companies?
Yes. And on the Citigroup side, $325 million is not huge by Citigroup standards, but it's certainly a lot of money.
Well, we're reading in your reporting, federal ethics regulations restrict government employees from participating in matters that involve companies with which the official is seeking a business, contractual, or other financial relationship that involves other than a routine consumer transaction. But as we said, Jared Kushner's office said he did not discuss these loans during his meetings with these companies. But others are saying there's a smell test here.
There was the question of what meetings he took with people in his White House capacity and what was discussed. Jared, by many accounts, not just the people we talked to for this particular story, has been meeting in the White House or as a White House official, but in some other location than the White House, with people from industry, real estate, infrastructure. As you know, the president has talked a lot about it, a bold infrastructure initiative that would bring in private companies as co-investors. That includes some companies that are in similar or adjacent businesses to what he used to do. So he's held these meetings with people, and the truth is we don't know whether in the course of any of these discussions on policy matters, the question of loaning money to Kushner companies came up. But even if they didn't, there's an appearance problem. And others question whether there may be more than an appearance problem.
Well, the man who met with him from Apollo Global Management is Joshua Harris. Three people familiar with the meetings, the Times writes, say the men discussed a possible White House job for Mr. Harris. So those who are, you know, sniffing at this to look for that bad smell say that, well, why wouldn't then a Mr. Harris turn around and lend this huge amount of money in the hopes of securing that job in the White House? But, of course, as we say, both Jared Kushner's office and the company are denying that. The company says that loan was in the works for a long time. But what about other ongoing work? As you write, Jared Kushner steers American policy in the Middle East, and his family company continues to do deals with Israelis.
Sure. And there have also been questions about his family company's efforts in China to attract new investors into some Kushner company's properties here in the U.S., some of which could potentially make those investors eligible for expedited visa programs. And that has become a point of concern and intrigue in terms of Kushner companies and even just the appearance that they have some extra influence because, after all, their former CEO and family member, because remember, this is a family company in which Jared's father and his siblings, I believe, play a significant role. In terms of Harris and Apollo, My understanding is that job discussion, the possibility of Harris working in the White House, was something that happened either early on in the presidency or possibly during the transition. The loan was finalized November 1st, so those discussions certainly did precede the loan. And for all we know, that discussion could have been picked up again later. Harris was advising White House officials on infrastructure policy as part of this trillion-dollar infrastructure initiative that the president had announced. So there were quite a few touch points. The ethics experts that we talked to said, and I think this is a reasonable point to raise, he didn't need to take these meetings with these real estate executives or these lenders. He could focus on other issues that were remotely apart from what Kushner companies might have been doing on a day-to-day basis.
Others are saying, you know, that Mr. Trump might not have hired his son-in-law. That was also a point of contention. But we'll see where this goes. Kate Kelly of The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we should note that Jared Kushner stepped down as chief executive and sold some of his stake in Kushner Companies last November, but he kept the vast majority of his interests in the family business.
Put your phone down. Come on, you can do it. All right, I know it's difficult because the truth is these pocket supercomputers are very hard to put away, and there are biological reasons for that. But say you wanted to free yourself from your phone a bit and not check it 47 times a day and actually do other things. Well, science journalist Catherine Price says it's possible. She's author of the new book, How to Break Up with Your Phone, and she joins us now. Catherine, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
So breaking up is always really hard to do.
As the song goes.
Why does it feel so hard to break up with your phone?
I mean, well, let's clarify first what we mean by breakup so that listeners don't just shut off their radios when they hear that word. Breaking up with your phone is not about throwing your phone out a window. It's about taking a step back and figuring out what a healthier relationship would look like and then making a plan for how to create that relationship.
Okay.
So don't freak out.
So it's not like we can't see each other anymore. Maybe it's like we need some healthy time apart, reassess, and then move on from there. Point taken.
It's like couples therapy.
Yeah. Okay. So when did you first realize that maybe you needed to reevaluate your relationship with your phone?
I would say it was about 2.5 years ago. I'd recently had a baby, and you know this was an ongoing process, but the crystallizing moment came when I was sitting one night with her in the dark, late at night, exhausted. And I had this kind of out-of-body moment, maybe because I was so sleep-deprived. And I saw the scene as it would look from the outside, which was her looking up at me with her little newborn eyes that were developed just enough to focus on my face. And I was looking down at my phone, searching on eBay for antique door hardware, which is this peculiar passion of mine. But anyway, I thought to myself, wow, I don't want this to be my daughter's first impression of a human relationship, let alone her first impression of a relationship with her mother.
Yeah. Well, but to cut you some slack, I mean, I've been where you are those late, impossibly late nights with very, very young children. And sometimes a break from the grind of that is what you need. And the phone does provide it. So
definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I don't mean to be judgy about that. For me, it was just a moment of like, you know, like, how often have I been doing this, though?
Yeah. Well, so that's the thing, right? So much of our interactions or how much we use smartphones today, we just don't even realize it, right? Then that's part of the challenge.
I think that's exactly the point, right? The biggest point I can make is that we just haven't thought about our relationships. But just by thinking about it or just having a, that's interesting moment, you've already started to change, because I just don't think we've really even begun to think about this issue until very recently.
Yeah. So, I mean, would you say, I mean, you're a science journalist, so you bring that eye and that analysis to your book here. And would you say that we have a lot of people who have unhealthy relationships with the technology, the super technology in their pockets and purses?
Yes, I would. There's a time tracking app called Moment that you can use to track the time you spend on your device. And it has about almost 5 million users at this point. And I contacted the guy who made that, and he told me that the average user spends 3 hours and 57 minutes per day on their phone, so nearly 4 hours a day, which is basically a quarter of our waking lives. And that is not counting time we spend on phone calls or listening to music or times when the screen's off. That is just time when the screen is on. So to me, anything you're spending 4 hours a day doing is something you probably want to look at a little bit more closely to make sure you actually want to be doing it.
Yeah. You know, I personally am very sympathetic to what you just said. But on the other hand, like a while ago, last year, I had a fantastic conversation with Sherry Turkle. She's at MIT. People have probably seen her TED Talks about sort of the isolating effects of intense uses of screens. She's been writing about how we should sort of teach ourselves again how to have good conversations. And I told her, I said, you know, one wonders if this is the reaction that we have to almost any new, utterly transformative technology, right? Like when the printing press came along and there were a lot more books, were people saying, oh, no, we're spending too much time reading books and not enough time, you know, in the public square or listening to stories being told by our elders? I just wonder, like, how much are we at risk of overreacting in terms of what our relationship with this new technology is?
Well, we certainly have a long history of overreacting or, you know, in retrospect, overreacting to technologies. My favorite example of that is the kaleidoscope. There was this time in Victorian England where everyone was actually freaked out about kaleidoscopes because they were so mesmerizing that people actually were walking around the streets looking into kaleidoscopes much in the same way that we look into phones. So there is that. But I actually believe that phones are different. And it is just not – it's not just me who believes this. There's a guy named Tristan Harris who started a movement called Time Well Spent. He's a former – designer at Google and does a lot with ethics of design. And he points out that phones really are different in that, I mean, not only do you have them on you at all times and they have access to the entire internet and more, but you actually have people on the other side of your phone actively trying to get you to spend more time on it.
Yeah. Phones are different. Smartphones in particular are different. I mean, you have chapters about this. Give us a little bit more about what you've written about. Like, there's a whole chapter you have about your phone is changing your brain. So how is it changing our brains?
So, for example, Nicholas Carr, the author of a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brain, points out that the internet is actually perfectly designed to change our brains. If you then think about how the phone is not just the internet in your pocket, but has all these other things in it designed to keep us on them, I think it becomes even more convincing of an argument to say that we are changing our brains.
Right. You were saying that they're also the way the phone is designed and the apps that are on the phone are designed, are consciously designed to sort of harness things that go on in our brain that make it hard for us to put them down. Essentially, you know, all the dopamine squirts, things like that, that make it virtually addictive.
Right. So dopamine, that's also a word that comes up a lot when we talk about this. It's a brain chemical that is basically a salience indicator, meaning that when you encounter something that your brain determines that you should pay attention to or remember, it releases dopamine. I mean, among other neurotransmitters, but that's a key one. And then if you think about your phones, every time you check your phone, you're going to see something that is in some way arousing, you know, emotionally. And when that happens, you keep checking in anticipation. And eventually you become like Pavlov's dogs, where you anticipate a reward, so you start to crave your phone. Right? So you get into these cycles. Phones are very much designed to take advantage of this part of our brain chemistry. In terms of how are our phones designed to keep us coming back for more, there are a lot of features, if you start paying attention to the phones, that really stand out, particularly social media apps. And my favorite example is the fact that the feeds are endless. That's deliberate. And why would that be deliberate? Because we're actually not the customers for social media apps. We're the product that's being sold. They're advertising companies and data collection companies. And the more data we give them and the more time and attention we give them, the more money they make.
So for people who maybe want to reassess or change their relationships with their smartphones, I mean, what's the first most important thing you recommend they do?
The most important thing I think you should start with when you're trying to assess your relationship is to think about a bigger philosophical point, which is that your life is what you pay attention to. You're only going to experience and remember what you pay attention to. And so when you're making a decision in the moment about what to spend your attention on, you're making a much broader decision about how you want to spend your life in general.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important to remember that we're not saying phones are bad. Phones aren't bad or good. They're phones. They're very useful tools. They've got all sorts of things that are fun to use and that really do bring us closer together with people. So that's not the point. The point is to ask what we want our relationships to be with them. And I also think it's useful to frame it a little bit differently. We tend to think of, oh, God, I want to spend less time on my phone, which feels restrictive. What we really should be saying is, I want to spend more time on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then asking yourself what that means to you and then making changes to live up to that.
Well, so most of the book then is this guide, this step-by-step plan for how to reevaluate your relationship with your phone. You did it in a 30-day plan format. Why'd you do that?
Basically for several reasons. One is that it takes time to change a habit. And so you're not going to just be able to change your habits in a day. I mean, number two, kind of related to that, is that most things I've seen written about this issue conclude with a list of like tips and tricks, like turn your phone to grayscale or rearrange your apps or don't charge your phone in your bedroom. And all of those are very useful. Definitely, I would recommend them. But if you don't do that in a broader context of a bigger goal, then I think you're just going to turn your phone right back to color as soon as you want to take a picture, which is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So the 30-day plan is meant to give people a time to actually change behavior. And the other reason is that, going back to the point about our phones, training our brains to be more distractible, kind of pushing them back toward their default state of distraction, if you actually do want to start building your, I call it muscle of attention back up, your capacity to focus, you need to take the time to actually incorporate an attention building practice into your life and then stick with it for a while in order to see effects. So those are some of the reasons that it's not just a, you know, one day tip and trick kind of thing.
Yeah. And so tell us, what are a couple of things early on in the plan that you recommend people do?
One thing is to get a sense of how much time you're actually spending on your phone. I call that kind of your triage. And that's when I recommend using a tracking app such as Moment, or there's one called Quality Time for Android. And that'll just measure, you know, how much those little pickups are actually adding up to and how many pickups a day you have, and then which apps you're spending the most time on. And then the next step is actually to begin to catch yourself in the act of checking your phone. Because as we were talking about at the beginning, part of the issue here is we're just not really aware of our own behaviors. We haven't thought about them, and we don't even, you know, you often pick up your phone and don't know how it got there. I call that a zombie check. You're like, oh my God, I have no idea even what I was checking to begin with. So in order to begin to check yourself and catch yourself in those moments, I recommend that you create what I call a speed bump for yourself, some little obstacle that makes you stop and have to decide whether or not to continue. So for example, you could put a rubber band or a hair tie around your phone. Or I actually created lock screen images people can download. It's phonebreakup.com is the book's website. And those are free pictures you can put as your lock screen that say things like, do you really want to pick me up right now? And what for, why now, what else, which is another suggestion.
What
and the
else,
idea really,
yeah.
What else? And really the idea is to just give you that stopping cue, that momentary pause where you're jolted out of autopilot and you have to decide whether you want to continue. And if you do, it's totally fine. I think that's another key point, is that there's no judgment here. I mean, it's your time and your attention. You decide how you want to spend it. But too often we do that without thinking.
Catherine Price's new book is How to Break Up with Your Phone. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The traditional thinking in sports is get the best players you can, train hard, and win as much as you can. But there's another route. Lose on purpose. Take some time to rebuild and get better players in the next draft. Purposefully tanking is apparently a problem in Major League Baseball. And in basketball, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver slapped a fine and spoke out against it this week. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, and is the editor of the upcoming book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. But Mike, to tanking,
yes.
Not for betting purposes, but to get a better draft pick. I mean, can you get everyone on a team on board to do that? I mean,
you don't have to. Good question. So this isn't the players on the teams going out and trying to lose on purpose. That's not what's going on. But what it is more of the GMs, or the people who construct the roster, either before the season knowing they don't really have a chance and playing for the future, not this year, or during the season when it becomes apparent they're not good, or as the case with the Memphis Grizzlies, their really good player Mike Conley goes down. You don't replace him. You don't make a trade to get better. You say, I might not make the playoffs at all. I'm better off trying to be bad and vying for a top draft pick in a future draft.
Yeah, but sometimes it is more spoken. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban was the one who was fined $600,000. He's on a podcast saying, I'm probably not supposed to say this, but I had dinner with a bunch of our guys. And I said, you know, I was like, losing's our best option. I mean, we're going to tank. You know, what he said. And so
I think it's brand extension. You know, the show is Shark Tank that he's on. I just thought of that. Sorry. But it does seem to me that what Adam Silver, who's a really good GM and he knows it's a problem, all he can do by tisk-tisking and making fines is this, drive the method underground. Because the method is logical. It is logical if you're not going to be good or even mediocre, just to be really bad. You stockpile for the future. Look at baseball. You know, the Astros won the World Series. They had 3 years in a row where they had fewer than 108 wins. Sorry, they had 108 losses, I should say. Yeah, that's a lot fewer than 108 wins. There was one time I remember the Astros GM was saying that he looked at the team, his lineup that game, and they were playing the Yankees. And there were five players on the Yankees who each got paid more money than the entire lineup of the Astros. So you do it to save money. You do it to be terrible for a while. And then when all your good draft picks come in and you want to spend more money on free agency because you've been saving it all these years, you can really go for it in a big way. There is some logic to it.
Well, I'm going back to Mark Cuban. More of what he said in this podcast. I explained what our plans were. It's going to be like a year and a half of tanking. You know, then we'll be better. Now, this is as I also had that report on sexual misconduct in the Mavericks office. I like the Mavericks. Rick Carlisle is one of the biggest boosters of women in sports. In a straight hour, he said he talked to, you know, Mark Cuban about this. I mean, here it's out there that he, you know, his team was going to tank, Rick Carlisle's. He says, oh, he's embarrassed by it. What does it do to a team when that gets out?
Yeah, it must be dispiriting to them, but the players know that they can only do the best they can. And also they want to play for the best contracts. And it must be dispiriting to Rick Carlisle, a guy who's won NBA championships. But sometimes as an employee, you execute the firm, you execute the organization's vision. And there's a lot of evidence that it can have its appeal. It can work in the long run. So I guess Rick Carlisle's forced into being a good soldier, a losing soldier, but a good soldier.
Oh, and I'm depressed. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what's your favorite Mozart piece? Is it Eine kleine Nachtmusik? Or the Magic Flute Overture. Or Marriage of Figaro Overture. Or any of the 600 other pieces Mozart wrote, starting when he was a 5-year-old child prodigy with father issues. And in the eyes of our classical music columnist, Fran Hoffner, that makes Mozart the Justin Bieber of classical music? Wait, what? If I was your boyfriend, never let you go. And Fran joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Fran, you write, and I'm not kidding, what's the Bieber connection to Mozart?
Well, I think it's sometimes tough to realize because classical music feels so long ago that these guys in their teens did have the same kind of level of celebrity that our very young pop stars had, including Justin Bieber, that, a lot of Mozart's work was done in his, late teen years.
And he made some choices that some others might have seen as erratic. That has a little bit of Bieber in it. And Bieber was just 18 when he put out Boyfriend. We were just listening to that. And we asked people for their favorite Mozart. And you land on, and again you say, don't laugh, Symphony No. 29.
Yeah.
Why?
It's a little bit of an obscure one, but I think it's just so nice.
Nice. I mean, nice feels like Minnesota, you know?
You know, it does, but maybe as a Midwesterner, I'm sort of like, that's great, though. That's the highest of compliments.
Well, let's listen and tell us what we're listening for.
Thank you. It's a melody that just immediately invites you in to listen to it.
Yeah. And Nice doesn't make it less musical?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I think, Mozart was always working on different variations and explorations of melody, and that 29 resonated with me as, I think, just sort of a gamble. But this is the one that, to me, just sort of, like, clicks.
Okay, so that was the Allegro Moderato, or relatively fast. There's also the Andante. Which you say is pure nap music, if you've ever heard it, and you mean that in a profoundly respectful way?
I do, yeah.
Because why?
You know, it's peaceful, and it really lulls you into a sense of comfort. And by saying that you could fall asleep to it, I don't mean that it's not engaging. I mean it really sort of calms you down.
Yeah, you say Mozart has tapped into your neurons and told you to chill the hell out.
Yeah.
Which is often a good thing. But picking up again on the Bieber connection, when Mozart wrote Symphony 29, he was 18, as Bieber was 18 when he wrote Boyfriend. We heard a little bit of that. Mozart was also kind of a restless musician in the Salzburg court. He got fired because he went rogue. He traveled to Vienna looking for better jobs. So we have to think of it that way, too.
Yeah, definitely. I think you see Mozart in the Salzburg court, not unlike how we saw Bieber sort of transition out of his teen years in a kind of like reckless and irresponsible way. I think Mozart got sort of stir crazy in Salzburg. It eventually felt too small, too contained, and that's when he went to Vienna and things really sort of blew up for him.
Yeah. So back to the Symphony 29, we want to listen to the Menuetto, some distinctive cellos at the end. What are we listening to here?
I mean, it's a little pretentious in a tongue-in-cheek way. This is definitely music for court and for dancing, but it still has... what I've come to learn about Mozart is that his music always had a really nice sense of humor about itself, and I think you can kind of hear that in the Menuetto.
How do you not love it, you ask us. Then the last movement, Allegro con spirito.
With spirit. This is the sound that I think people most traditionally associate with Mozart, is this really enthusiastic and encouraging kind of tone.
Cheerful, exciting, no stressful tension. But again, doesn't that make it a little Bieber-esque? I mean, classical music is also supposed to make us think, make us feel conflict, isn't it?
Yeah, I think sometimes there are symphonies, especially later, more romantic ones, that really kind of put you through emotional turmoil to reach a big and joyful ending. And for this, in the way that we see pop music, I think that sense of conflict is a little less than, or a little maybe just like lower stakes.
Because he hasn't really probably come across conflict yet. He's a teenager. As you ask, he wrote with this when he was 18 years old. What were you doing when you're 18 years old? Not too deep, maybe.
Yeah.
But he did have those issues with his father. You recently visited Salzburg, Mozart's birthplace, and we were reminded there's those scenes in Amadeus where the father figure is terrifying Mozart. Here's a delusional Mozart imagining his father's coming after him for yet another composition.
It's him. Who? The man. He's here. Tell him to go away. Tell him I'm still working on it. Don't let him in. No, wait. Ask him if he would give me some money now. Tell him if he would, it would help me to finish it.
So there is a depth. Was this music then maybe an escape for him from that tension of his father?
it definitely could have been. And I think he used his music generally to help him understand, I think, himself more than anything else. There's a lot of pressure you see, I think, just generally speaking, in being the child of another musician and artist. And so for him to create as prolifically as he did, I think in part was also to just like push himself further into understanding what he could do rather than being a reflection of his father's art.
What was it like to go to Salzburg?
Oh, Salzburg is gorgeous. It's just this very little city right embedded in the Alps. And it's so wild to be in a place that is so enthusiastic about Mozart kind of as a whole. To like walk past shop windows with Mozart's face on them, on t-shirts and on tote bags and all that.
Oh, you were in heaven.
Yeah, it was great. There was, you know, I saw like a Letterman jacket that said Mozart in big letters on the back. And I was like, ugh, I'm like 5 years too old to spend a lot of money on this, but maybe one day.
Were you also trying to imagine a teenage Mozart, you know, maybe with his peeps, as Bieber was, you know, throwing signs or whatever, you know, on the streets of Salzburg?
Yeah, I mean, I think he did have this sort of like artistic posse of people who liked and trusted and surrounded him and kept him in kind of a bubble of celebrity.
So Mozart, the nicest music, which you mean that as a huge compliment.
I do.
And your favorite, Symphony 29. We'll ask listeners for theirs. They can leave a comment at hearandnow.org. Fran Hoffner, who writes about classical music with her own distinctive slant. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump has convened a summit at the White House today to deal with the country's opioid epidemic. The focus will be on prevention, treatment, and funding. In October, Trump declared opioid abuse a public health emergency, but communities say there has been little action or money from Washington in the months since. Drug overdoses are taking the lives of 115 people a day now, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And in many parts of the country, these deaths are often blamed on a culture of despair. That despair is especially felt in rural coal mining states like West Virginia. Wyoming has been losing mining jobs too, yet somehow opioid overdoses aren't nearly as devastating there as in Appalachia. But some health advocates say the storm just hasn't hit Wyoming with full force yet, and the state needs to do more to get ready. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Raising her three kids in Cheyenne, Wyoming, Penny Hunt always knew that her youngest son, JT, wasn't like other kids. As lovable and creative as he was,
he grew up kind of as the daredevil, and I always worried about him.
JT struggled with anxiety. By the time he was 14, he was addicted to his anti-anxiety medication. By 15, he was in rehab.
He got out of rehab, was doing better, and had a wisdom tooth pulled and was given pain meds. And then the cycle started over again.
When JT went back to get more teeth removed,
I asked the dentist if I could talk to him in his office. And I said, my son is an addict. You cannot give him addictive medicine. And he said to me, I signed an oath that I cannot let my patients leave in pain. And I said, then give him Tylenol.
Hunt said she left frustrated that the dentist didn't see the problem with prescribing to an addict. Still, her son found ways to get painkillers. She wanted him back in rehab, but Wyoming has only 8 adult live-in rehab centers, and the wait lists are long. So she started making calls.
And I kept being told over and over again, 3 months, 6 months, we can't get him in. We can do an assessment, but we can't take him. If you know anything about addiction, if you have someone who's willing to get help right now, things need to move right now.
Finally, Hunt found a bed for her son in neighboring South Dakota. When he got out, she thought he might be okay. But then he didn't call for 3 days. When the police broke into his apartment, JT lay dead on his couch, overdosed on prescription opioid meds at 23. Hunt says her experience with medical providers and a lack of rehab space needs to be addressed in Wyoming. Research scientist Rodney Wambi at the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center agrees. He's working on a study of opioid addiction in the state, and he says Wyoming is seeing a rise in opioid addiction and overdoses.
We do have a problem. I think it's just not the crisis that you are seeing in other parts of the country.
Back in 2004, only 19 people overdosed on opioids in Wyoming. 10 years later, it had ballooned to 96. But Wambeam says other coal mining states have it much worse.
Compared to, say, rural Appalachia, where the people lose their jobs and coal mines have shut down and they stay, and they have a culture of despair.
Here in Wyoming, when energy workers lost their jobs, they often left the state, so it's hard to know if they developed addictions or not. But Wambeam says now that Wyoming is monitoring opioid use, more medical providers are scaling back how much they prescribe. The goal is to get proactive before things get worse.
I think we're doing the right things, whether it's educating pharmacists and doctors, whether it's having prescription take-back events, whether it's having naloxone in the hands of first responders. We're ahead of the curve. I don't think that we're just waiting for the storm to hit us, right? We are lucky that way.
Erica Matthews is the Wyoming Health Department's Substance Abuse Prevention Manager. She says her office started fighting the problem early. Now, every county has a prevention coalition, and every first responder has access to naloxone. That's a medication to stop an overdose in its tracks. But in a rural state, the challenge is getting people to use those services.
I mean, you've talked about the frontier nature, and that is one of our biggest challenges, and the lack of supports that we do have in the state, but we do have other supports in other ways. We are such close-knit communities that we are able to make grand changes in those communities in a much shorter period of time.
But Penny Hunt says that close-knit community can also be tight-lipped. She says she kept her son's true cause of death a secret. The autopsy called it bronchopneumonia. She says lots of people do the same, and that's why Wyoming's data on opioid deaths may be skewed.
It's coming, and it's here, and Wyoming is really good at, you know, keeping our family things to ourselves and not talking about it, and so it's here, it's not being talked about.
In hopes of lifting that stigma, Hunt's oldest son, Jeremiah, put an interactive map called Celebrating Lost Loved Ones on the web, where families can post photos and share stories. His late brother JT's young, smiling face is just one of hundreds that have been posted there. For Here and Now, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.